All right, friends, Greg Kokel back with you with my colleague John Noyes, and we are continuing our critique of a critique. Ready to go another round with me here, John?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Drew, the genetically modified rather skeptic from the internet, has provided a critique of my class from STRU, Standard Reason University, on atheism as opposed to theism. And my case there was taking a look at these two worldviews and then taking a look at three different features of reality and asking which worldview, classically construed, is better at explaining these three important features of reality. And I started out, and we talked about this, John, the last hour, with the what I call the bump of stuff, in that my argument is simply a cosmological argument, precisely the Kalam cosmological argument, given that the scientific evidence is so strong for an absolute beginning of the universe. The question is, what caused it? And the two options are either something or nothing. And since nothing doesn't seem to be the odds-on favorite, metaphysically, it doesn't fit with our principle of causality, sufficient reason, etc., then something must be the cause. But what is that thing? And I argued, well, to cause the beginning of the universe, it requires certain characteristics that are very much like the God of classical theism, and so therefore the best explanation for the cause of the universe is the God of theism, not atheism, which leaves you with no cause if the universe had a beginning. At least that's what we know right now based on the best evidence from science, all right? So Drew had concerns about that. We addressed those concerns and hopefully cleared up some confusion that regarding the way I was making my points. And now we get a chance to do the second and the third bump. And the second bump I call the bump of bad. And the reason I call it the bump of bad is because bad is something we all bump into, right, John? I mean,
that's right.
I mean, the classic challenge to theism is the problem of evil. Yes. And the way it is usually characterized, and we'll get to some detail on this, is that there is evil in the world, but you say your God is good and powerful, so how can that be? And notice the usual way that it's characterized is an acknowledgement of the evil that's in the world. So, and here is what I trade on, what philosophers call moral intuition. We are aware of something non-physical, that is, morality, and we are aware that morality is violated, creating bad things, wicked things, evil things, and this is why people all over the world, the way I put it is no matter where you live or when you live, know that something's wrong with the world. And the something that's wrong is moral. That's why they bring up the problem of evil. And so having made that introduction, I won't read what I say in the video that Drew actually includes in his critique. I want to make the point, I'm looking at my notes right now to get clear on this, that when we complain about evil in the world, we are not talking about merely about our feelings. We seem, and you could ask yourself this question, when you look at something and you say, that's wicked, that's evil, that's wrong, that ain't right, however you put it, are you talking about the thing itself or are you just describing your autobiography? And that's the difference between objective morality and subjective morality. Right. If you're talking about the thing out there, you say the thing is objectively wrong in itself. Even if people don't think so, it's still wrong. If you're talking about your own feelings and opinions, and that's it, that's the way where it ends, then you're talking about subjective or relativistic morality. And it turns out you're not talking about the thing at all. You're just talking about yourself. Now, you have to ask yourself the question, what is it that you're referring to? And I know what you're referring to, and so do you. You're thinking about the thing itself. Okay, this is a monumental point here that I'm making that I don't want anyone to miss. And Drew gets the point right away. So why don't you read for us, John, Drew's sure. characterization of my point.
Yeah, absolutely. So to that, he says, all right. That's quite a setup for this point. So why is it important to establish objective morality here? The problem of evil, he goes on to say, requires things actually to be bad out there. Mm-hmm. It requires objective morality. Okay. And the existence of evil then needs to be a detail of the external world to be a problem. It can't be just a matter of our own personal opinion, okay? Some things have to be wicked or bad or evil in themselves, regardless of personal opinion, in order for there to be a problem of evil.
Okay, here Drew does an excellent job
of
summarizing my point. So the question now I have for Drew, John, is does Drew believe there is actual, real, objective evil in the world? Okay.
Right.
And remember, in the last statement, Drew was summarizing my point. Let me just see the last statement here. I want to make sure. Yeah, I think I got it right here. That Drew was summarizing my point to saying, okay, so he's summarizing me, and then he's going to respond. But I just want to put it back into context. Okay, right. Some things have to be wicked or bad or evil in themselves, regardless of personal opinion, in order for there to be a problem of evil. And here's how he responds.
Yeah, so coming off the summary, this is what he says. No, actually not. Not at all. The problem of evil is a critique of the internal consistency of Christian theology. It assumes a Christian moral paradigm that evil exists, and it pits it against the Christian conception of the nature of God. It suggests that those things are inconsistent with each other, since God's supposed omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent nature should not allow for the existence of evil. No moral standard outside of Christianity is required to raise the problem of evil, because the problem of evil deals exclusively with a Christian moral standard. And then he goes on to say this, and I think that this is really important. Maybe I shouldn't be at this point, but I'm honestly shocked that Kokel doesn't know this. How do you work in Christian apologetics for this many years and still not understand the basics of the most common objection to Christianity?
Okay,
I really want to hear how you respond to this, Greg.
Okay, thank you, John. I will say that to me, this is, and I'm just speaking descriptively here, not condescendingly, this is a stunning response. Does Drew really believe that evil is a problem in the world only in the sense that it creates an internal contradiction for Christianity? Does he really believe that? That, as he puts it, no moral standard outside of Christianity is required to raise the problem of evil? Does he really believe that to raise the problem of evil, you must first grant a Christian moral standard hypothetically? Now, this is what's surprising to me, because it seems to me that he thinks that the problem of evil is only a hypothetical, not a reality, and it's only a hypothetical within the context of a Christian worldview. Now, he does have a point here, and I'm going to get to it in just a moment, but this broader point, when he seems to isolate the problem of evil within Christianity, and by the way, I don't think I'm misreading him here. He does that quite aggressively. Does he really think that evil is just a violation of a hypothetical Christian standard, that people in parts of the world that are unfamiliar with Christian morality have no sense there's something really morally wrong with the world? I mean, Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs and Buddhists and all sorts of different religious folk, they're not aware of this? Now, people are just going to have to decide for themselves, but it strikes me that the problem of evil is not a Christian problem. It is a human problem.
Yeah, that's good.
It does express itself in its unique way inside of Christianity, but it is not contained inside of Christianity the way that Drew seems to be characterizing it. And so I might be misunderstanding him, but he hit the issue from a couple different angles. So I don't think so. Now, I want you to notice what Drew is doing here. Drew is trying to refute the moral argument by denying the second premise, and I didn't actually give you the argument proper, so let me do that here.
Okay.
And that is, the way the moral argument works is that the first premise is, if there is no God, then there is no morality, objective morality. The second premise is, there is objective morality. the conclusion is, therefore, there is a God. Now, this is a logically valid argument. It's in the form, deductive form of modus tollens. And if the first two premises are true, the conclusion follows with a certainty. Right. Now, what's interesting is that though I give my argument in reverse order with the premises, Drew never takes exception with the idea, the first premise, that if there is no God, there is no objective morality. And there's a reason why, we'll see in a moment, he does not believe in objective morality. All right? He believes in subjective morality, and he explains that. Okay. But this is his point. He's trying to refute my argument by refuting the second premise, and that morality is objective. And by the way, if he does that, well, then, then my argument fails. All right. Yeah. All you got to do is hit one premise. If it takes it out, then the conclusion doesn't follow. But notice that what he's claiming, the second premise is there is objective morality in the world. Okay. It does exist. And the argument I use to make the case that objective morality exists is the problem of evil, which is available to everyone in the world, not just Christians, contrary to Drew's apparent claim, okay?
Yeah.
So let me take it from there. Drew says, here's the second issue, I'm honestly shocked that Kokel doesn't know this. How do you work in Christian apologetics for this many years and still not understand the basics of the most common objection to Christianity? So to that I respond, of course I understand the internal contradiction way for expressing the problem of evil. This is called the deductive problem of evil. And incidentally, just as a point of information, it's largely abandoned by philosophers because it's been resolved. Okay. But the reason that I don't mention all of those philosophical details is because I've almost never heard the problem brought up that way by people who mention the problem. Okay. I'm responding to the specific thing that most people actually say. And what they say is there is evil in the world. And according to your worldview, if God is good and powerful, then there wouldn't be evil in the world. And when I lecture on this particular point, I do make the statement, John, that the end around here is just to contain evil or to contain the contradiction just within the Christian worldview without making any reference to evil in the world. You Christians believe there's evil. You also believe that God is good and powerful. That's internally contradictory. The problem is, and this is my response to Drew, that is not the way that people talk about it. What people do is intuitively and I think accurately acknowledge there is real evil in the world. So that's an important distinction here. I know about this stuff. I don't encounter it like that. When I encounter it like that, then I deal with it. And in fact, in the story of reality, I do address the deductive problem and show what the solution to it is. And this is where I think that Drew misunderstood what I was trying to accomplish at this point in the class. I wasn't trying to address the apparent internal contradiction, the deductive problem. Rather, I was simply identifying a common sense awareness that people have of evil in the world. And then I was simply asking, John, if there is evil in the world, then what are the worldview implications for the question of theism versus atheism? That was my project, okay? Now, Drew continues, and why don't you pick it up from there?
Sure. John. He's going to continue on that, and he says this, and I quote, Kokel continues to discuss moral relativism for a bit here, repeating his point of, a few times. Eventually, he sets up an argument for God's existence for morality, because in order for there to be laws that are broken, there have to be laws. And in order for there to be laws, there have to be lawmakers. And in the case of evil out there in the world, transcendent evil, if you will, there have to be transcendent laws that are broken to create a real problem of evil. And if there are transcendent laws, there must be, watch this, a transcendent law maker.
Okay, Drew does a great job again of summarizing my point, and this particular characterization entails both of the premises of my argument. And like I said, Drew never takes exception with the basic line of logic, the first premise, which I have gone to lengths to illustrate in my class there. But right. now he's going to all offer an alternate explanation for the reason that people seem universally to believe in morality and violate morality. It just occurred to me, if the people universally believe this, if it's part of human nature, he makes a reference to that, then it certainly, this awareness goes beyond Christian theology, which seems to contradict what he said earlier. Pardon me for chuckling, right. But I'm just thinking, because again, I'm not trying to be derisive here, but that does seem to be a contradiction, but maybe he can resolve it. Doesn't matter. Why don't you go ahead and pick up where Drew moves
sure.
next.
Sure. So he goes on and says, I can appreciate an observation Kokel makes. Here, humans, regardless of time, place, or culture, do tend to share their perception that moral structures exist, possibly even outside of their own minds or groups. That suggests a root cause behind this phenomenon in human psychology. Where Kokel and I differ is that I don't just jump to the conclusion that some transcendent intelligence is behind it.
Okay, so there's beginning to be a split here that I want people to see. Notice how he says, I acknowledge that people share their perception of moral structure. Now, it's subjective, he's talking at that point. And then he talks about the root cause is human psychology. That is still subjective. He is not addressing, well, maybe indirectly is, my claim that this is an objective state of affairs. He's suggesting rather it is subjective. And he says, and consequently, he doesn't jump to the conclusion of transcendent intelligence behind it. Well, I didn't jump to the conclusion, John. I rather offered a conditional. If there are real laws, there must be a real lawmaker. Curiously, Drew kind of agrees with that point. He just suggests a different lawmaker. My case is that we have reason to believe in transcendent laws, which he's going to reject. Therefore, we properly infer a transcendent lawmaker, but Drew does not believe in transcendent laws. And let me just read this one here, because it's just, sure. It's just a couple of sentences here. Drew says, I think natural selection, an extremely well-evidenced process, acting on a social species like human beings, could produce this phenomenon. Okay? I don't think anyone is defending the problem of evil by explaining how morality could arise through evolution. They're just explaining how a naturalistic process, which we know occurs, could account for the existence of the moral nature of humans. Okay, so please understand, I am not saying anyone is defending the problem of evil. I'm saying that in the course that Drew is beginning to take, they are denying the problem of evil, saying, in his words, it's a phenomenon in human psychology, or, as he puts it, a perception that we have due to evolution. So he continues. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, and he picks up and he says, we are social species, and those within a social species who are more willing to cooperate with other group members of a group are selected for, as cooperation provides a survival advantage over members of the species who act independently out of self-interest. This is an evidentially well supported this is an evidentially well supported hypothesis.
You said evolutionary because that's what he's talking about.
I'm still thinking about his last statement. Anyways, okay. He says this is an evidentially well supported hypothesis for how morality arose. And then he goes on to kind of finalize this thought with, it's not a definitively established fact, in my opinion, but it's better supported than the God hypothesis, which renders completely superfluous.
Okay, now I am going to take exception, John, in a moment, whether this is evidentially well-supported hypothesis.
Okay.
It is a hypothesis from an empirical methodology. Whether we have evidence that it could accomplish that is a different, create morality or feelings of morality or beliefs of morality. That's a different matter entirely. But he says, well, the God thing is superfluous. And my response is, he's absolutely right. It is superfluous if you reject moral realism, which he does.
Yeah.
That if it turns out that the second premise is false, which is what he's arguing, that there is objective morality, then of course there is no need for a lawmaker. There's no laws. All right. So I'm with him on that. What I'm challenging now is the substance of his rebuttal of the second premise, his refutation of the second premise, and that is the refutation that it's not objective, it's subjective, explained by Darwinian evolution. And keep in mind, by the way, that all of this at this point, excuse me, and he'll continue here, entails a denial that there is a real problem of evil in the world, not just one that looks like a contradiction within some theological systems, but in the world objectively itself, okay?
Yeah.
And in case there's any confusion on this claim, I'll let you continue reading, Jim.
Yeah. Well, he says as much. He says, I don't believe in objective moral facts in the supernatural sense that Kokel does, so I don't need to explain their existence, is what he
says. Well, he's right on that. I'm just going to jump in here. I'm not sure what Drew means by supernatural here, and if we were together having a conversation, I'd need clarification. My sense is he means transcendent.
Sure.
Supernatural means above the natural, and that's the same as transcendent. In any event, truly clearly rejects moral realism in favor of moral relativism, which it turns out is the only kind of thing that Darwinism can produce. He continues.
Yeah, he says, I don't think humans have a common moral nature. Sorry, I do think humans have a common moral nature, and that nature is most likely a result of our common evolutionary origin. This explanation of morality is not entirely certain, no, but I think an explanation with some supporting empirical evidence is better than one which relies upon little more than anthropomorphic intuitions of human psychology.
Okay, now it's interesting here, just notice that he's saying that he has evidential support from an empirical method for his view. That's Darwinism.
Right.
And then he's dismissive of my view that he says relies on little more than anthropomorphic intuitions of human psychology. Okay, I get it. All right, so I want to talk for a moment about the problems with the Darwinian account of morality, because it is, I see this frequently, a kind of waving of the wand of Darwinism to explain a lot of things that nobody actually goes into detail to show how Darwinism actually explains it, okay?
Sure.
And so if you want an empirical, that's why I said earlier, I mean, it took exception with this idea of evidenced that he made reference to. In any event, I'm going to talk about four serious problems with trying to explain morality by Darwinian evolution. First, and this may seem controversial to a lot of people, but when Drew employs neo-Darwinism, I mean genetic mutation and natural selection to explain morality, I think he's leaning out of bent reed. He's polishing the brass of the Titanic. Now, he's going to totally disagree with me on this, but I just want to point out some things that are happening. In the field, there are a whole bunch of people that are moving away from the neo-Darwinian synthesis because of its inadequacy. Okay, so, for example, in 2008, a group of influential evolutionary biologists, okay, they met for a private conference at the Konrad Lorenz Institute in Altenburg, Austria. They have since come to be known as the Altenburg 16. And they met because they were convinced that the neo-Darwinian synthesis, natural selection and genetic mutation, had run its course and was not able to explain the origin of biological novelty. Okay, well, those are maybe outliers. Some people did. All right, but it's not just them. In November of 2016, okay, this is about 5 years ago, the Royal Society met in London. on the topic of, quote, new trends in evolutionary biology. Now, the Royal Society is the most prestigious scientific association in the UK. It's the oldest scientific community in continuous existence in the world. All right.
Yeah.
They describe themselves as, quote, a fellowship of many of the world's most eminent scientists. And it is. This particular meeting in 2016, my friend Stephen Meyer and Doug X both were there, and they told me all about it. At that presentation, the Austrian evolutionary theorist Gerd Müller gave the first presentation, and here's what he said, quote, current evolutionary theory largely avoids the question of how the complex organizations of organismal structure, physiology, development, or behavior, that would include morality, by the way, actually arise in evolution. Wait, I just want to make sure that you get this. At the Royal Society meeting in 2016, one of the leading evolutionary theorists says, you know what? Evolution doesn't really explain what it is meant to explain. And this is why this conference was called New Trends in Evolutionary Biology. We have to find some new ways to characterize evolution other than the standard Darwinian thing because it's not working. All right?
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. People can take that for what they want, but there are huge changes that are going on. The question of the legitimacy of the neo-Darwinian synthesis model for explaining not only biology, but behavior as well, which morality would be one of those, is under question by the Darwinists themselves. Okay? They don't have any respect for people like Stephen Meyer and Doug Axe, but they were able to attend this thing and see what they're saying. Okay? So in my opinion, Drew is leaning out of Bent Reed here. He's counting on Darwinism to solve the morality problem for him. Okay. But let's say he's not wrong, he's right. This is a completely dependable system. If the Darwinian account is sound, I got a second question. How exactly does a biological process produce false beliefs about morality? Well, why do I say false beliefs? Because they are false beliefs. We believe that rape itself is wrong. But according to Drew's characterization, our beliefs tell us nothing about rape. They tell us about a revolution. Biology can't make an act wrong. It can maybe make us believe it's wrong, but they can't make the act wrong. So it gives us a false belief about morality. And by the way, I'm just quoting Michael Ruse here because he's a well-known atheistic philosopher who's an evolutionist. And he says, quote, we are genetically determined to believe that we ought to help each other. Close quote. That's it. Anything else is an illusion, he argues. Genetic determinism, not real morality. Okay, so my question then is, given the Darwinian model, even if we accept it as totally legitimate in biology, in what sense is goodness or badness a physical thing that can be produced by a change in our body chemistry, our genetic mutations? I mean, John, genes might determine our behavior. Precisely how do they determine our beliefs? And this strikes me as a category a mistake because behaviors clearly can be determined by biological processes because it's a biological result. But a belief is propositional. It's not biological. So this is another problem. How exactly does that work? I haven't seen anybody try to do this. They just wave the wand of evolution, and as long as they can imagine a reproductive benefit, they presume it must have been done by evolution, but they haven't shown that. Okay, that's two problems.
Right.
But let's just say evolution does work in a biological way, and let's say evolution can cause us to have false beliefs about morality. When I say false, they don't match reality. They're just a reflection of our genes, all right? But this creates another problem. What if our beliefs about morality are pre-programmed? What other beliefs do we have that are pre-programmed? Okay, what else are we genetically determined to believe? Incidentally, this is not, I'm not just making this up. I didn't come up with this myself. There's a lot of people talking about this, from C.S. Lewis to Alvin Plantinga, the philosopher, all right? Because the question is, how can our mental apparatus be trusted to know anything when everything we believe is dictated by our chemistry?
Yeah.
Which also puts Darwinism itself on the chopping block.
That's right.
If our beliefs about morality are genetically determined, predetermined, why aren't our beliefs about evolution genetically predetermined, or beliefs about creation genetically predetermined? Everything. This takes knowledge, real knowledge, completely out of the equation. That needs to be resolved and answered. Okay?
Yeah.
So what if I granted all those things? Darwinism works. Yeah. It can create beliefs, and it doesn't interfere with our other beliefs about other things. Okay? This is another problem. What's the end result? The end result is relativism. When it comes to morality, morality is merely relative. There is no objective right or wrong there. Nothing is ultimately bad in itself. Now think about the consequence of this. That means rape and child molestation and human trafficking and slavery and genocide and name your poison. All right? These aren't bad in themselves. We just think they're bad because of our evolution. This is an unmistakable conclusion that follows from this way of thinking.
Yes.
Evolutionary beliefs are mind dependent. The mind goes out, then the beliefs are gone. Objectivism holds that things are right or wrong in a mind independent way. They're wrong in themselves. Even if nobody believes they're wrong, they are still wrong. Okay. And back to Michael Ruse here. Morality is an illusion. It's simply a psychological belief put in place by natural selection in order to maintain and improve our reproductive fitness. There is nothing more in them than that. End of quote. Well, that's not just Michael Ruse. That's Drew's view. That's what he's explained. And that means, to put it simply, there is no actual difference between Hitler and Mother Teresa. Not morally speaking. We may feel differently, or some people may feel differently. I'm almost done with The Rise and Fall. I'm in page 1100, almost done. There were a lot of Germans who loved Hitler, didn't think anything he was doing was wrong. All right. That's what you get with subjective morality. And anyway, so this raises a question for me then about Drew's own statements about me. Now, I haven't fussed about these things because it doesn't matter to the assessment. But as you've been reading, you know, there have been a number of challenges that were made to my character by Drew based on the way I offered my arguments. And he said, for example, you're harming atheists. He said that my treatment of the definition of atheism with these are either lazy or deceptive. Those are his words. He suggested that I care more about scoring points against atheists than actually having a real conversation. Okay, that's Drew's assessment. I'm not taking exception with his assessment. I'm asking the question is, what is the nature of his assessment? What does he mean when he says those things? When he makes these moral assessments of me and my presentation, is he simply acting out his evolutionary genetic conditioning? This is the question I ask. Or is he making a genuine moral assessment of my character? No, I think Drew thinks he's doing the latter.
Right.
But according to his explanation of morality, he can only be doing the former. He's merely expressing his genetic determinism. He's talking about his evolution. He is not talking about me,
right,
or about my behavior.
That's a good point.
So notice, by the way, that this is Drew's main evidence against the moral argument. Moral argument being, if there is no God, there is no objective morality, but there is objective morality, therefore there is a God. He went totally after the second premise. He put all his, you know, all his chips on that issue and argued aggressively that morality can be explained by a process called Darwinian evolution that can, at very best, even if it works in spite of all of the objections and concerns I expressed regarding it, still can only give us a subjectivistic, mind-dependent morality, and that is called relativism.
Yeah.
And therefore, there can be no problem of evil. There can be nothing that's really bad. There can be nothing that's really good either, by the way, in the objective sense. And that is the price that you pay if you go that route. All right.
That's a great explanation. Yeah.
Okay, John, let's do the last bump. We got about less than half an hour here, but I think we can get to it. This is called the bump of me. And now I'm looking at the human condition. I'm looking at human self-awareness and an awareness of the self and the value of the self and meaning and purpose and all those kinds of things that people ask about. Not everybody all the time, but almost everybody asks at some point in their life, especially when they get older.
Right.
And the distractions are not enough to keep them from ultimate issues. In any event, I talk about the hungers of the human soul that are unique to humanity but are real and are not physical. And then I make the point that souls are actually real.
Right.
Okay? And because I'm going to argue that the locus of these things that we're thinking about, human value, human specialty, the specialness of being human, human significance, all of those kinds of things are not physical qualities. They must be residing in a physical place. And I argue human beings, if we are equal, that can't be grounded in our physical selves because there's nothing equal about our physical selves except for our generalized humanity, okay? And that is not the way we argue that. Human rights, okay? So we have different capabilities, skills, and all that other stuff. Anyway, so then Drew reacts or responds to that, and here's what he says. It's the most people feel significant quote there. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, he says, most people feel significant in some vague sense. I'll agree. But I'm not sure if that feeling is in conflict with a naturalistic view of humanity or what Coco calls being a piece of meat in motion. Maybe naturalism scares Kokel, but plenty of naturalists like myself get by just fine with feelings of significance sufficient enough to enjoy life totally intact.
Okay, good. Interesting. There's a lot here, but let me just say quickly. First, I'm not scared of naturalism. I think it's false.
Yeah.
Okay, doesn't scare me. Well, I don't know what there is to scare me, but that's not what's going on here, just so you know. Second, notice his words that most people feel significant. Okay. The question that I'm exploring here is whether or not the significance people feel is just a feeling or whether we have reason to think it's more than a feeling, whether we actually have transcendent objective value or meaning and significance, that we are just more than meat. So just to be clear, this is what I'm after. We both agree that we feel these. Now the question is, what grounds the feelings?
Right.
Are human beings special, unique in some transcendent way, or is this just a feature of human psychology? Okay. Now, in order to make my point here about these being features of the soul, I need to give some reason people ought to think that they have a soul or that they are a soul. Now, I did mention in my presentation, John, that I think people are already aware of this. Think of this. I'm a woman in a man's body.
Right.
Okay, so when you think about the gender confusion and the way it's characters right now, doesn't that require an immaterial self that one thinks is gendered in a way that is in conflict with their material self?
That's good.
To me, that's a common sense notion.
Yeah.
And but in any event, though, because we think very physicalistically in our culture, I wanted to give an illustration that I've given many times. It's a soul experiment, okay? And so what I invite people to do is close their eyes to imagine their mother doing some task, washing dishes, working at a computer or welding or riveting or something. So I don't know, some sexist here.
Anything.
But whatever it is. Imagine that, and then I ask the question, what color of shirt or blouse is your mother wearing? And then I ask people to open their eyes and tell me, and they give me these different colors, okay?
Right.
And so then I ask this question. You saw your mother in this image, yes. You saw her so clearly you could describe what she was doing and the color of the clothes she was wearing, yes. Where was that thing you saw? And then I make the point that the thing you saw was not in any physical place because physical places are third person public. That is, in principle, you can go and we could all go and see the same thing. I've got a cup of water here. It's physical. In principle, anybody can view that. But what we saw was first person private. Where was that? And since it wasn't in my brain, you crack open my brain, you're not going to see it. Okay. So it was somewhere, but it was not somewhere physical. It was somewhere non-physical. And since we are perceiving it in a non-physical thing with ourselves and non-physical eyes, we must have a non-physical self that beholds that. The location of that image was in our soul, is the conclusion that I drew. Now, this was not at all satisfying to Drew, and here is his response. Here is his response to my soul experiment. Okay? Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, so he says, so today I want to see an image that I saved on my computer. I saw it on my computer once before, but today when I went to look for it, I couldn't find it. See, I cracked the computer in half and then just dug through its components, but I was never able to see the image. Naturally, I concluded the computer must have stored that image in its soul, which is why I didn't find it. Sure, when I saw it the first time, you know, the computer's disk drive and the graphics processor were running, but that's not what I saw. It was the computer's soul, obviously. This reasoning is nonsensical. It makes an observation, proposes an untestable explanation for this observation. An incorporeal soul then throws out any naturalistic explanation, like brain function, without giving any reason for doing so. Finally, it concludes that since no natural explanation exists for this observation, the untestable explanation must be true. This is God of the gaps, or rather, soul of the gaps, in an instance where there's not even a gap. Okay, I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, so you're probably familiar with the way he's arguing right now, and Drew's move here is to rebut my evidence for the soul by offering a parallel that leads to an absurdity, okay?
Right.
So he gives an illustration that he thinks is parallel with my soul, a reflective soul exercise, and then he shows that the illustration leads to the ridiculous conclusion that a computer has a soul, which he knows I would never affirm. So the technique here is called a reductio ad absurdum. In tactics, we call this taking the roof off. So this is a noble critical thinking tool that he's using. However, now this is very important for people to see. It only works if the illustration, John, is meaningfully parallel in a way that is relevant to my point.
That's right.
And sure, in both cases, there is an image that disappears.
Right.
Okay, but that turns out to be the only parallel.
Right.
The fact is, there's no meaningful parallel between a person seeing a first-person, private, non-physical image through conscious introspection. And by the way, I don't know how anybody can take exception with that. It is a person, and there's a whole crowd, seeing something that is private to them only, that is non-physical, doesn't have any physical qualities to it at all, doesn't extend in space, it doesn't weigh anything, you know, it doesn't, it's an image, and they're doing it through conscious introspection. There's nothing, what's the word I'm looking for, controversial. There's no ledger domain here, there's no sleight of hand.
Right.
That's the one thing, and Drew's parallel is using his physical eyes to see a third-person public physical image that appears and disappears on the screen of his computer.
Yeah.
The computer is not conscious. We are. The computer displays the image for a conscious person to see with his physical eyes, but the computer is not seeing the image itself. We
That's
are
right.
the subject. Remember, the analog here is me and the computer, right?
Yeah.
Well, the computer's not conscious. I am. The computer's not seeing anything. I am. Okay? The in the case of me as a conscious being, there's an internal activity going on.
Yes.
Where I see an image that's not physical. And by the way, the internal activity is not something I'm presuming. It's something I'm aware of. All right.
That's right.
Even though not physical, though it's very clear, we can describe the details and the color. So my question is simply, where is the image that we saw? And as I pointed out, it's not in the physical world being seen with the physical eyes as in Drew's illustration. It never was. So I concluded that since it's a real thing we saw but didn't exist in the physical world, it must be in a non-physical place. And I offer as an alternative the souls, because physical selves see physical things with physical eyes. And we also have the ability, this is so obvious, we practice it all the time. Imagine this, imagine that, think about such and so, picture this. We say these things all the time. We have the ability right. to see non-physical things that are not in any physical place. And by the way, he mentions brain activity. Okay, good for him. But it's not relevant to the point. Of course there's brain activity. No one denies that. What we are seeing, though, is not brain activity. What we are seeing is an image that is clearly not in our brains. All of that is reflective and evidential to my point. I'm not just throwing out a soul of the gaps with no reason. These are all reasons. The claim that all kinds of physical things are going on in the brain that can account for the image misses the point of the illustration. And this is where I think Drew, unfortunately, is talking past my point.
Right.
The question isn't what physical things are involved to help you see the picture. That's not the question. The question is, where is the picture?
Yeah, yeah. That's good.
It's not in your brain. It's being held by ourselves in a non-physical space or place. And the self that is beholding it is not a physical self because we are not seeing it with our physical eyes. I mean, so there we go. And now Drew says, well, simply asserting that no physical or naturalistic explanation for a psychological experience does not prove that psychological experiences are non-physical. And I agree with him. But that's not what I was doing. I was not making an assertion. I was engaging in reflective introspection. Physical things have physical qualities. The image people see in the exercise doesn't have physical qualities, so it's not physical. Even if physical processes are involved in causing it, okay?
That's really good.
Drew says, you aren't justified in simply saying that the soul did it or God did it when you don't understand something. The problem here, John, is not that I don't understand something. It's that I do understand something. What I do understand is the difference between a physical image and a non-physical image, okay? And
right.
Andrea says, seriously, if you want to convince us of a huge claim like the soul exists, you have to actually provide evidence for it. Well, I did. It was the evidence from personal introspection and the evidence based on a reflection on the nature and the properties of physicality.
Mm.
So once again, I want to say that again. So I'm reflecting on what it means to be physical, okay? What are the properties of physicality? And then there is something that I behold that does not have those properties, so I properly conclude that it's not physical, okay? It's interesting. Drew said earlier that I had made a point that was a non sequitur, and you know, it's interesting, if it was a non sequitur, Drew certainly didn't know that by empirical evidence.
Yeah, that's
good. He knew it by logical reflection, which is the same kind of thing I'm doing here. Now, just because I'm using that tool doesn't mean I'm right in the way I'm using it. But what I think Drew has been doing has been just simply dismissing that as a legitimate means of inquiry and has always consistently gone for the naturalistic explanation, which, it seems to me, is clearly not adequate to explain the effect in this particular case, okay? There's more I could say here. I'm looking at the clock. Moving on, I could talk about Gottfried Leibniz's principle of indiscernibility of identicals. I could talk about remote viewing and out-of-body, near-death experiences and all kinds of other evidential points that support the notion of the soul. But what I'm simply saying is there's no parallel between my exercise and Drew's illustration. It doesn't mean my exercise proves my point. People have to decide about that on their own. But it does show that Drew's attempted rebuttal, his comparison with a computer image fails as a reductio, and therefore his rebuttal is not sound because his parallel is not parallel. So I'm not making my point. I am rebutting his refutation, okay? And I think I have done so effectively because the lack of genuine, meaningful parallel. Now, we just got about 8 minutes to go here, John, and
not much time.
Yeah, not much time, but I want to say something about human value. This is an important point here at the end that I make, and that is I'm making the case for unique human value, transcendent human value. There's something wonderful, I say, about us, and the wonderful thing about being human is not in our physical bodies. I kind of hinted at that just a little earlier. And then I say, this is why we don't treat human beings like animals. This is why we can gas termites but not Jews. Now, Drew did not like that reference, so go ahead and read what he said there.
No, and he cuts the video right there of you speaking, and he says, okay, let me just jump in here. Oh, I don't want this video to get restricted again. A claim is not an argument. I agree that humans tend to value humans. I just think this is explainable through the process of natural selection on a social species.
Okay, good. Now,
interesting.
Notice he jumps in. This is a scoff, all right. I don't want this video to get restricted again. Like, he's tempted to say something that's going to get him restricted because I made this comment about we don't gas termites, but not Jews. That's a moral issue for us, all right? And what he says in explanation is that we tend to value, notice the appeal to subjectivism again, okay? That's what Drew is referring to here. But my point is actually very simple. Did I use a dramatic way of characterizing it? Yes. Did it get a reaction out of him? Yes. But I have to ask this question. Given that my point is we don't gas Jews because human beings have transcended value where termites don't, so we can gas termites, does Drew disagree with this? Does he agree that it's wrong to gas Jews in the objective sense, but it's not wrong to gas termites? That's all I want to know. Yeah. He scoffs at it, but does he disagree with it? How could he disagree with it? Now, I think all he's left with is saying, well, this is our social contract, which, by the way, is the way the Nazis argued at Nuremberg. I was doing my job. I was following orders. This is what my culture told me to do. Now, he might not go that direction. He might say, well, we shouldn't do that to Jews because that's our revolution says that. But that doesn't tell us anything about whether we should kill Jews or not. Gas them. It just tells us what our evolution tells us. It's subjective, not objective. And so, and keep in mind here, this is what Dawkins says. He says, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. Now, why no justice, according to Dawkins, the 20th century's most famous atheist? Why no justice? Dawkins tells us, the universe is that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's his statement. It is completely consistent with his naturalistic atheism. Now, it doesn't fit well with we shouldn't be gassing Jews, okay? Because that is a moral statement that doesn't fit in his worldview as an atheist, okay? There's no grounding in atheism for it. Now, I'm not saying, please, don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that atheists believe we should gas Jews. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is atheism does not provide any moral principle that's inherent and native to atheism why we shouldn't do that. That's the point that I'm making.
Right.
All right. We're just molecules in motion. And if, you know, some of us have an evolution that say it's wrong, other people apparently had an evolution that said it was just fine. And how do you break that tie? You can't on a relativistic scheme that Darwinism, which is the only thing that Darwinism can produce. Now, Drew goes on to say, well, I can still feel special and value human life as an atheist. And that's true.
Which is true.
Yes, I don't take exception with that.
Absolutely.
But notice that it's all subjective. I can feel special. Are you special? Objectively, transcendently. No. You can just make the best of it. That's the classical existential response, by the way. Our decisions make meaning for ourselves, all right? And then I talk about human guilt. Maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. How about that? And he denies that. He just says that's just a mechanism. It's just a work. Again, the feelings of guilt have survival value for the species, and he kind of offers that, the Darwinism
right.
explanation again. And so it's kind of more of that here. I acknowledge fully that atheists can construct a life that is genuinely satisfying for them. Okay. But on the foundation, though, when it comes down to the meaning of life, there is no such thing. It's only what we make for ourselves. And that's really all that he's left with. Now, look at it. This may be the truth of the matter. It may be true that there is no God and morals are just simply relative, but I just want people to see the assault on our deep intuitions about the nature of reality, the assault right. on the notion of causation, for example, that I talked about earlier, the assault on our notion of, and by the way, that's sufficient cause, sufficient reason, the assault on our moral intuitions that tell us there actually is evil in the world and there is good in the world as well. And there is that problem that isn't restricted to just Christianity. And then finally, the whole notion of the human predicament, that humans have value that's transcendent, that's unique. Christianity answers that, that says that the soul of human beings is made in the image of God, and this is what grounds our moral obligations towards each other and also our human rights. John, I wish we had another hour because we have a lot more we could say, but thank you so much for helping me out on this. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. It really is. Thanks
and,
for having me.
I hope this was helpful for the rest of you as well. Please take a look at Drew's original video and make notes if you like. That's Drew, the genetically modified skeptic, as he critiques my class from Standard Reason University called Atheism, Bumping into Reality. And then listen to these 2 hours of response and may the best idea win. All right? Greg Kokel with John Noyes here on Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye.